Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for March 27th, Saturday, 2010. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic for today is concerns the cataclysmic shifts underway in the world at large, and the question, which way will the United States go? Now, that for us is not rhetorical, you know, on what side we are, the side of humanity, but we have with us to discuss this question of really profound, epic shifts, two people who are very day-to-day concerned with two opposite parts of the globe geographically. I welcome live here with me in the studio Ramtanu Maitra, who is our, as we call it, New Delhi Intelligence Desk. Welcome, Tanu.
Thank you. Thank you, Marcia.
And he has a report and background and descriptions of some events based in Eurasia concerning the Indian subcontinent, and some strategic updates. But I also welcome from right here near us, she's speaking with us on the telephone from Washington, D.C., Michelle Lerner. Hi.
Hi, thanks.
Okay, good. We're connected. Good. And Michelle is with the LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouche Youth Movement in Washington, D.C. Michelle, I think you've been leading the charge there for a couple years already, right?
Yeah.
So for quite some time, and she should get the, if there is one, George Washington Valor Award for being on the scene in this wild place of the capital of the United States. Because just by way of introduction, I don't think I have to remind anyone that it was just last weekend, on Sunday night, just a week ago, that there was this forced march passage of this Obamacare, Nazi-modeled so-called health reform bill, which just is a mechanism for the way to impose killing people and also demoralize everyone that this should even be thought of in the United States, at a time when, in fact, we have a physical breakdown of the economy and we should be the world should be vectored towards how to build things up again as has been outlined in what's now called around the world the LaRouche Plan for organizing a new credit system, projects that we need for taking care of humanity and moving forward. But instead, our discussion today takes place in which every day the collapse process of the physical economy is even greater. If you think of the globe and look at the transatlantic nations that have been euphemistically called the developed economies in recent years, the breakdown is very impressive. In other words, every day, more job eliminations in Europe, the United States, Canada, and elsewhere. More government functions are eliminated, more schools shut down, more emergency rooms or whole hospitals are shut down. You go to see someone, if you're lucky enough in a hospital, half of it's shut down. The beds aren't there anymore. Now, that's so-called the condition of the developed sector in chaos that's worsening. And then you get what was always a euphemism for decades, the less developed or undeveloped, and you have the specter of Haiti, the half-island nation just off in the Caribbean near the United States, where we have hundreds of thousands of people left in a situation of facing another round of mass death from the rainy season floods and disease after they had the January hurricane, which took away up to 300,000 lives. And that's just being left to play out instead of being reversed. Now, as I say, I don't have to tell people who are regular listeners and followers of this show what side we're on. This has to be stopped. And we have a political social reaction to all this, which is a tremendous opportunity to break out of former molds, break out of the dumbness and so forth on the part of the general public and popular opinion, if it can go somewhere, if the leadership can be developed, and that's not an academic question. I'll just underscore, if you take a look at the rallies, not organized ones, but just protests erupting on the state and local level. This usually isn't publicized much, but 100 people here and there, 1,000 people in Pittsburgh, 1,000 people in Michigan. There was a last week Monday night, I find this is indicative of the state of the country. There's a hospital in California in San Leandro where it's there's a plan underway to shut the emergency room down totally. Hmm. And in future, maybe keep the hospital, maybe not. Well, the doctors, the nurses, the management, the unions, the non-unions, everyone turned out for a rally last Monday. And as many of them said from the bullhorn, 6 months ago, you never would have found us here. This never would have happened. Hmm. But now, this is where we are. This kind of thing has to stop. They had a bunch of signs to that effect. Now, I can't. But anyway, so this, as I say, raises the whole leadership question. And that is brings us to the LaRouche Political Action Committee, the campaigns that are being run as a national banner flag of unified intervention by the three congressional candidates, Texas, California, and in Massachusetts. But so the question is how to engage minds, how to educate those who are stepping up for this kind of thing. And so today, our two guests are concerned with very different subject matter, so to speak, from Tanu, especially from India and Eurasia, and Michelle Lerner here in the United States, and not only that, in the Capitol. But it's the same topic. How do we move things, people, institutions, in the direction of restoring action for the purpose of humanity, to go into the future, and to restore even the sense of purpose instead of the pessimism that's characterized allowing the what you can call the British Empire outlook to get this far for so long. So, Michelle, let's go first to Washington, D.C., where I said this. We had the specter of this passage of this bill last week, and then now we have the President of the United States kicking off a national campaign to go and try and force down people's throats how beneficial this plan is, which supposedly he and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, are gloating that it was passed with great support. So that kind of speaks for itself. But what observation would you make from where your vantage point in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think an appropriate starting point is actually 2 weeks ago when Mr. LaRouche gave an international webcast on March 13th, right before the proverbial Ides of March. And in that webcast, he started off by discussing how any discussion of the 2012 election is really code speak for 2010, and that not even being as late as November, but sooner, much sooner. And therefore, the webcast was made in reference to the Ides of March. On that same day, what had actually happened was there was a vote or an attempt taking place to try to isolate Keisha Rogers, the young woman who actually was at that webcast and spoke there for a few minutes. There was an attempt to isolate her out of the official Democratic political process within the Democratic Party, which, I mean, that speaks to what a democratic process is for the Democratic Party, considering that she had won actually 52-53% of the vote in what really was a landslide victory. Despite that, she really shrugged this thing off. But this we found out. Subsequently, we found out that this was an attempt that had been organized from as levels as high as the White House itself. So we already see on the day that Mr. LaRouche was making the point of what these Ides of what the Ides of March this year represent. We already see the White House acting in a frenzied way. To try to put out the fires that they're really stoking themselves. as people who regularly listen to the show know, that Keisha won her victory by actually calling for the impeachment of President Obama. So that happened on the same day. Now, within the following week, you had a huge drive forward by the president, almost single-handedly getting on the phone with Congress, really putting the pressure on them to vote for this bill. And he got to the point where he was admitting himself to the congressman that this vote actually is, the stakes are the presidency itself, that if vote it does not go through on the health care, then this is a major blow to the presidency itself. And congressmen were put in the position of having to defend themselves define themselves as either being in the Obama camp and going ahead with this vote, or being in the LaRouche camp and actually being for a movement of impeachment against the president. Whether or not that actually was the case with the particular congressman, we saw the case of Dennis Kucinich, in the entire process had been opposed to this health care legislation. Obama went to Ohio in his district and orchestrated this huge event, really putting him on the spot, and forcing him to make a decision that despite everything, every principle he stood on up to this point, that now he has to put all of that aside and declare himself as part of the Obama camp as opposed to the LaRouche camp. And so in a press conference on Wednesday of that week, he had come out and said that I guess this is now the 17th, I'm talking about 10 days ago, that he had no real reason for voting for the bill. He didn't particularly like the bill. There was no bargains made or anything like that, but that he had to vote for this bill in order to protect the presidency. That was really the only thing that he had said. And into the weekend, we saw a lot of these last-minute deals being made, pressure being brought on the Congress to get those last votes that they needed to pass this bill. Now, what happened in response to that, in fact, actually, on the 19th, last Friday, a week ago from yesterday, Obama himself gave a speech in Virginia where you have to have tickets. You can just show up and get in. And supposedly, if you were to show up early enough, it's a first-come, first-served basis. They were telling people to come at 9 a.m. to make sure they got into a speech that started by 11, because they thought that the place was going to be swamped, and they had an auditorium designed to seat 10,000 people. Well, you would think that in a situation where the President of the United States is giving a speech where it's free to come in, there's no really no restrictions, just that you had to go through the security and you weren't allowed to bring signs or anything inside. But you would think that you would have a huge crowd surrounding the place trying to get in. You'd think 10,000 wouldn't be able to adequately hold these things. Well, he couldn't even fill the auditorium because his popularity had already dropped.
And Michelle, you were there, right? Or friends, colleagues of yours were there, right?
Yeah, we were there. I was outside the whole time organizing and talking to people outside. I didn't particularly have an interest to go in. I've heard his rhetoric before and didn't need to see it again. So, but the odd thing was that by 10 o'clock, there was already, they had gotten everybody, they told people to come at 9, so they got everybody in. By 10 o'clock, there was really nobody left outside. And they couldn't even fill the auditorium, whereas even if you go back last year, that would have never happened. There would have been people, the place would have been swamped, people would have been trying to get in, you know, fighting over seats to get in. But in this case, it was not that. And I would say it wasn't all supporters of the president's plan. It was a pretty split in terms of who showed up. So that was on Friday. On Saturday, the next day, about 40,000 people showed up to the Capitol in protest of this vote, of this bill that was supposed to be voted on the next day. And I was actually shocked to see that there was no real press coverage of the fact that you had people just, you know, jump on a bus and overnight come up to the Capitol and rally all day long at the Capitol. What was covered was there was a couple of events where people got a little bit out of hand and rowdy, but it shows how angry these people actually are. And I mean, these weren't your average. This was not the war protest. The war protest was a separate protest that was happening on that day. That was a protest that was happening. I don't know how many. I know that was several tens of thousands as well at the White House. And this was the crowd that usually comes to these war protests. But this was a separate protest on the Capitol by people who specifically were in opposition to this bill. And we were there talking to people. The characteristic thing is that people see they see more than just this bill. They see this as a constitutional issue. They see this as a question of whether they can trust the government, which is really what is at stake with these types of tactics that have been going on. That we're in a crisis, a national crisis, where people no longer feel that they can trust the government. And they're taking out their rage on the Congress, on the president. And it's a very dangerous situation, but it's also a situation where great change can happen very quickly. So I would say there's the pressure is really up on us in our organization to make sure that we're getting out enough information, we're getting out the ideas that are required to actually solve the crisis that we're in. Despite the fact that people are upset about what's going on, they are very confused about what to do. And there is nobody in the Congress, there is nobody in supposed leadership positions that has put forward any alternative to the fascist policies that are being really shoved down the throats of the population right now. And despite the fact that people can recognize this as fascism, not having an alternative, they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. And it is our organization that has been putting out the alternative now for several years. If we had gone back and passed the HBPA when LaRouche had called for it in 2007, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in right now. We would have been in a totally different situation. So, as you know, the vote took place on Sunday night. This thing came down to it, really came down to the last minute. People, we really didn't know who, if they were going to get the votes or not. I know there was some sweet deals made with people in the last minutes. And subsequently, there was already, I know some of the protesters who had come on Saturday were still in town on Sunday, and subsequently you had, there was a number of outbreaks that have occurred this past week. And LaRouche just yesterday issued a statement warning about the threat of a British plot to assassinate the president, because these types of conditions are so dire that you can have if you find highly manipulable people, they could carry out such an attack. And the president himself, again, is stoking the fires that are about to engulf him. It really is the case that this past week has been, or the past few weeks has been, what really appears to be the process of the Ides of March. And now the Congress is going back to their districts there for Easter break. I'm thinking they might have to hope for the powers of being resurrected themselves, because I'm not sure what kind of fury they're going to meet with back in the district.
Yeah, it's not going to be the Easter Bunny as usual this year.
No. No. I don't think they're going to meet too many cute, cuddly...
No, bunny chickies.
...out there. But they're being told to go and now sell this bill to continue to talk about these things. Meanwhile, we're seeing now record highs of unemployment in particular states. Like, I think Florida is now over 12% unemployment, which is, I believe, a record for them. And the whole question of people's unemployment benefits is going to be coming up again. Meanwhile, the Congress is out trying to win favor over, or trying to sell themselves for passing this bill. It's a pretty wild situation, I would say. But warning that LaRouche put out, I think we have to take it very seriously. We did actually get that warning to every office of Congress. We brought that leaflet to every office of Congress yesterday before they go home. And a number of congressmen have already seen certain types of, they've received threats. Windows have been smashed, and there's really it's a very unpredictable type of situation. I can't say I've ever seen anything like it. And for all of those who should be happy for the victory they won, I can't say that I've seen much of an attitude of joy in their victory. They seem just as frustrated as ever, if not more.
Right. If we can ask you a couple points more about this, just what you said about this alert that you got to all the congressional offices and are getting around. Mm-hmm. One of the, we and others have an investigation going. This isn't just pro forma or something, but the milieu that you just described of desperation and then combined with manipulable people, you got swimming in there some people that have been around for almost a couple decades that have known connections to counterinsurgency, mm-hmm. of the classic British anarchist and other kinds. So I don't know if more has been brought to light, Michelle. I haven't even checked our own website in the last 20 hours. You know what I mean. But people listening and people should know to do that. We will make known anything about this on its pedigree, that because this is an immediate danger, as LaRouche laid out. The other thing is, let me ask you about what you describe is very vivid about the situation in the U.S., and you also are a venue in Washington for, you're the crossroads for a lot of international meetings. I know you, the Organization of American States, hosted a meeting on what's going to happen in Haiti that brought together a lot of Haitian Americans and others from abroad, the Haitian diaspora, as it's called. And there again, your forces, even if it's small, helped put out the kind of strategic situation that the world is in right now and what's to be done. Do you want to say anything about that or any other kinds of developments in the last few weeks?
Well, in respect to that, I can't say too much about this particular event, except that I know that we got very good reception since LaRouche has actually called for a continued effort to relocate the individuals in Haiti that are now facing these storm conditions, these rainy conditions, really treacherous conditions. But about that, is very interesting that that's one of the signs that we go out with on a regular basis, just says how many Haitians must die before you impeach Obama, which I would think at this rally on last Saturday, we actually got a very good response from people where the common stereotype of like the Tea Party crowd is that, you know, they're just kind of concerned about being overtaxed or that they're afraid of immigrants. And certainly there are people that have some ideological issues there. But despite that, there was a lot of people very concerned about the fact that we could be doing more in Haiti and that we're not. This is a concern of the American people, which is somewhat is striking to me. I wouldn't have expected that type of response. But then also last Sunday there was an immigrants rally, an immigration rally that wasn't. It was mostly Hispanics, Latin Americans, but there was also other. It wasn't exclusively. There was all types of immigrants, and there again, there was a lot of recognition on the issue of the way that the United States is intervening in the process in Haiti, and that it's really something that's almost being overlooked. You have the president saying, "Okay, we'll give you more money," but that it's not the money itself. I mean, you can really see the insanity is that we've cut back our troops to, I believe, maybe 6,000 now for a population of over 1 million people there. Where we had 20,000 troops. We've cut down. We've taken, like, a lot of the ships have come back. And we're saying we're going to send the money, but that's not, the money itself isn't, I mean, they're not going to hire the Haitians who can't even, you know, they can't even walk across the camps that have been set up because the places are flooded or mud. They're entirely muddy. I mean, we need a serious reconstruction effort, and it shows that there is a disconnect between what people think of as aid, between giving some money and actually going in there with the constructive physical help that is needed. But that I think the population is very is sensitive to this point.
Right. I think that and what you say often shows up too is people know we didn't do anything that we could and should do after Katrina, or we didn't do anything that we could and should do after you name it, fires or floods in California, etc. So it's what you've been describing. Well, let me ask you, I have other questions, but why don't we turn to Tanu, and then we can continue on this question of the really the critical question of how we're going to force the issue in the United States on this. But internationally, part of what we've been called, what is best sometimes to call the LaRouche plan, it involves that the U.S. should be collaborating with that side of Russia, India, and China that likewise wants to do what ought to be done on this planet.
Right.
And there are moves in the direction that people should know about. Tanu, why don't you indicate some of these in the last couple weeks?
Yes. A number of things are developing. I cannot be too... I'm optimistic, but I cannot be... I'm not looking at a crystal ball or anything like that. But there is definitely a recognition has come about within these three major powers who happen to be ensconced in an area where more than half the population of the world live. There's a realization among these three big powerful nations is that there are a lot of, you know, over the historical and the Cold War period, there are a lot of conflict issues existed because they lived in each other's border issues, relationship with third party and all that kind of thing. Created a lot of conflict points between these three countries, but these three countries now, and over a long period of time since the Cold War was over, that's 1990s, they have not been able to focus their objective or focus their attention to how to resolve these problems and move forward. And once you get into this conflict resolution situation, it never ends, because what happens to a historical conflict is that both sides have done wrong, because the history is so long that it becomes a sort of a name-calling session that comes about in the conflict resolution. So the only way to sovereign nation states can be friendly is when they start to realize that interdependency on each other, using the strength of the other, how it mutually benefits both the nations. And once that realization dawns on them and they start acting upon it, after having politically making it palatable to the population that they serve, then, you know, the conflicts can be resolved. And this is, you know, this is always the case. The other side, the British Empire, of course, British Empire's main objective is to keep these conflict points alive, because it is the British Empire had always expanded and prospered on the basis of dividing the various countries and ruling them because of weakening them through this division process. And so they are very good at creating, maintaining the conflict points, highlighting the conflict points, and so long they keep both these countries' leadership's attention on those conflict points, then their objective is achieved. Now, it was going on for a long time. I mean, if you consider India and China, I mean, well, the long history of India and China, you go back, you never see any single conflict in thousands and thousands of thousands of years. There was very little contact between India and China, that's true too. But, you know, the Buddhism came in 400 BC and it was picked up by the Chinese that came to India. But there was never any conflict existed between the Indian India and China. But what happened? One happened in 1962, and that is, you know, that is being considered by the British Empire servers, or people who live in the same echo chamber, or basically the echo chamber of these British Empire servers. They point out this 1962 conflict was so big and so disruptive that India and China can never, this 1.2 billion people on one side, both sides about 1.2 billion, they cannot resolve things and move forward. Now, this, what I am seeing at this point in time is that there is a definite indication that there is a realization within the leadership in both in Beijing and in New Delhi that there are many areas where these two countries can, through mutual cooperation, can advance and help the population, which is a large population. And it's a question of trust. This trust buildup is slowly developing. And recently, for example, in November, and then, of course, the Copenhagen summit took place in December, there was a joint agreement between India and China. And there is a full realization in both these countries that this climate change, the rules and conditions that are being put forward under the pretext of climate change and carbon emission is basically to undermine the development of these countries and particularly makes extremely dangerous the food situation for this large population. So with that basic understanding, that as the foundation, they formed a joint group in which they said that we'll work together to fight this thing and not allow this thing to go through, and they did. Once they did that, I think that there is a that was a very big step in developing the trust between India and China. Then, of course, India and China has a very big trade. I think that China is India's going to be the number one trading partner in 2011, but trade itself does not resolve these basic problems which are based upon trust. So since then, what I have noticed, a number of moves that were being made in strengthening the bilateral relations. One of the one area is the development. There is a in northeast of India, which is in a sort of remote from the mainland India, you can call it. There are a large number of nations other than India. It borders Bangladesh, it borders Myanmar, it borders China, it borders Nepal, it borders Bhutan. And right through the middle of that, in that area, runs a very huge river. It's named Brahmaputra, which is 2,850 miles long, but more than half of it, of course, is more than half. In fact, 70% of it goes through India. In the north, it is generated in the southwestern part of Tibet. It hugs the northern slope of Himalayas and the Tibet Himalayas, that junction. And since there is very little soil there, it basically it runs through a gorge. And then it comes down, it turns around the Himalayas at the very east end, and then swings into the southern slope of Himalayas, and then flows into the delta area, which is the Bangladesh.
By the way, let me add here, I just on the geophysics for people listening, I just noticed in rank order of the world, the Brahmaputra may rank more around 25 or 30 in length. But it's number 3 in the entire world of sediment carriage. Sediment. And so this delta you're talking about of Bangladesh, yes, is probably the biggest in the world.
It's entirely formed out of the siltation of the Himalaya southern slope. So, in fact, that silt has now spread all the way to Indonesia. If you take a satellite picture, you will see the silt has spread like fan all over to Indonesia. So over a million years, there will be no Bay of Bengal, there will be no Andaman Sea, and Indonesia, Southeast Asia, India's east coast will be all part of the land mass. But there's a heavy silt it carries. It also carries enormous amount of water because it takes the water from both the slopes of the Himalayas, which is enormous amount of water, and it comes down very fast, and it sweeps into Bangladesh, and where it really meets, about 40 miles north of where it meets Bengal, it looks like a sea. You cannot see the other end of the river. On an average, the river is about, you know, about 12 kilometers, which is about 8 miles wide. But it has got sandbars and all that during the dry season, all these show up. Now, this is a very difficult river to manage, and this has been since Bangladesh came into existence. In fact, before that, there were talks about how to prevent this enormous amount of flooding that is happening, that happens in Bangladesh. Bangladesh came into existence in 1972, but before that it was East Pakistan. And since the India-Pakistan relationship was extremely animus at that point in time, it's not infinitely better now, but it was very, very hostile on those days. There was any resolution of the Brahmaputra River was out of the question, because Brahmaputra River comes through India, falls into what was then East Pakistan, flooding the East Pakistan. But there was no interest on the Pakistan side to prevent this flooding. So only way this flood could have been prevented is to do the water management of this river. Now, subsequent to Bangladesh's birth, this was brought about, and one of the solutions was, and we pushed it, EIR and Mr. LaRouche always had this in mind, this Brahmaputra River Basin resolution will solve enormous number of problems in a very large area where more than 350 million people live, so which is larger than Western Europe. And it has also got tremendous potential to develop industry and agriculture and all that. But most importantly, it borders a large number of nations. So it has to be a joint cooperation effort, and which will give it a extreme goodwill, will develop at a very high level between the regional countries who are benefiting and participating in all this. So Indian proposal was to take the Brahmaputra River at certain point and dump it into Ganges River, which is west of it. And because Ganges Basin is very heavily populated, so water is drawn out of it in an enormous amount. So this Brahmaputra surplus water would serve the purpose of Ganges, serve the people's requirement from Ganges, plus it will also reduce the sedimentation of the Ganges River itself. So these are all proposals never went anywhere. But now, suddenly, Bangladesh has a prime minister, Sheikh Hasina was the lady, and she was always very close to Mrs. Indira Gandhi, and she is now prime minister for the third time, but the strengthening of India-China relationship has given her the opening to go to India and say that we are willing to participate in this river basin development. Then she went last week to China, and she asked China to cooperate on this. China immediately on the spot said yes. So, that means that the Brahmaputra River Basin development will now be done by China, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, Bhutan, and perhaps a little effort from Myanmar. Now, what is interesting to note is that China doesn't get anything out of it, because this is far south of China. And so there is no financial, short-term economic benefit China is not getting, but China is willing to participate, which means China is interested to emerge there as a large nation who is interested in the development of the infrastructure of nations who are, its neighbor. So therefore, it is, particularly India participating in it. This means another area of trust is going to develop. And this is all happening in the area where the India-China border dispute exists. So it's right by the border that this thing is being done. And China doesn't find it difficult to participate, nor does India. So these are the signs you can see that these large nations who have, tremendous amount of capability in the regionally to develop infrastructure and then exploit the maximum out of that infrastructure to develop the population as a whole. And there is a there is a directionality now. In for example, India's next five-year plan, which starts from 2012, Prime Minister has said that he wants $1 trillion to be invested in infrastructure. Now, these are pretty large number. And if they are being fully and properly utilized, it can bring about an enormous amount of change within the five-year period. China is investing very heavily in infrastructure. Now a Chinese delegation has come to India to discuss agriculture, and particularly on this genetically mutated seeds and all that.
Because China is working on outside the cartels, I think.
Yes, China is working outside the cartel. India it has run into difficulty because of the cartel, and if they can find a way out to get out of the cartel, there is no technological or scientific quarrel with the GM variety of seeds. And that has been made clear by the Indian Ministry of Agriculture that, you know, the seeds are fine, but the conditions that are being put in by the cartel is not satisfactory for the farmers and not satisfactory to us. But India is also trying to develop its own GM variety of seeds. But with Chinese help, this will be of tremendous advantage and tremendous good thing. But then, having said that, I must point out that this India, China, Russia, which is developing in a quite a fast clip recently, has its a negative element. The negative element is because the realization that United States has become completely incapable or uninterested to participate in these areas. They have, you can call it reluctantly or through cautiously at least, are now getting together to resolve this problem. This is also creating an anti-US, general anti-US attitude over there. For example, US should be blamed for it 100% in the sense that in Afghanistan war, not the war per se, I think there is no quarrel between US, China, India, or Russia on the war on terror and Taliban or Al-Qaeda or anything like that. All of them agree that this is not the kind of force that should be in power. But having invaded Afghanistan and is there for more than 8.5 years, the opium production has multiplied, and it has now, it is at least, 8 times more than what at the highest opium production during the Russian invasion days. And this opium is going into Russia, India, China, Pakistan, in the entire region, Iran. And U.S. is paying no attention, and basically the British policy, which is, the British East India Company's prosperity came mostly from opium sale to China. At one point in time, more than 50% of empire's revenue came from opium sale. So the same policy is not that U.S. is pursuing that policy, but U.S. reluctantly are...
passively following London.
Passively following London and looking the other way while the opium is growing and opium is being harvested and opium being converted into heroin and is pushed towards Russia, pushed towards China, pushed towards Iran. Now, this has created a great deal of unhappiness in Russia, China, and India, that the United States is really allowing this region to get destroyed, the population of this region to get destroyed by this enormous flow of opium. So there's an anti-U.S. thing has developed because U.S.'s unwillingness to participate in this opportune time where these three nations who had difficulties getting together, but now they are getting together. At this point in time, an U.S. input into that will change the world, because you have to remember that no matter how big China is, how big India is, or how strong Russia is, the amount of global reach any of these countries have is nothing compared to what United States has. And United States has military is unequivocally the most the biggest and most powerful and has the capabilities which none of these countries even put together, they can have that. So therefore, the U.S. is needed. U.S. is needed more than, but U.S. is needed in this milieu where these three large nations have come to realize that through cooperation, they can develop the area, region, and provide sustenance and improvement of at least half of the world's population. But with the U.S. participation, the other half of the world's population's improvement becomes a possibility, a reality. At this point in time, it is not, despite the fact that these three nations are getting together and trying to resolve some of the problem. I'm fully confident that they will be able to resolve the regional problem. But when it comes to the global problem, it needs United States participation. And the United States has not, particularly this administration, I particularly say this administration because in the last 2 or 3 years, really, the India-China-Russia cooperation has begun to emerge. I'm sure that the talks were going on for a long time. They were feeling each other out. The process of developing trust of each other was in progress, but it has now come to a point in which they are getting implemented, and this implementation time. If United States, this administration, could move in and say, well, I do understand that you guys are trying to resolve a problem which United States always tried to resolve before, and I need to participate in this, to cooperate in this, and with my cooperation, this effort in your region not only be better, but it will also include the other half of the world, other half of the population of the world. So this is what is missing at this point in time, and this is a very big miss. If this thing continues like this, then no matter how great the cooperation between these three countries could be and how much trust they can generate, the real resolution of the world's problem, which includes, you know, population's problem, the huge population's problem, will not take place, and more people will die. Agriculture will run into difficulties. Power shortages will destroy industries, and the destruction of industries will create joblessness, hopelessness, and terrorism, and all these kind of desperate forces will come to play. So therefore, it is extremely important that this realization come in Washington, that, you know, what was, say, 6 years or 7 years before, it is much better now, because these two countries are now have started to focus on what beyond their own boundaries, and they're looking at the region as a whole, where at least 50% of the world's population live. So I see that there is a great deal of hope at one end, but on the other side, I see a great deal of frustration. I feel greatly frustrated because United States not only is getting weaker by not participating in this thing, but is losing its capability. Over a period of time, it will lose its capability to have its global reach. And that will be not only a shame, but a disaster for the world as a whole.
We certainly described the stakes.
Yes.
And which, when Michelle opened the discussion, it's the same thing, but
yes,
it just in different terms for mankind on the whole planet Earth. Michelle, do you want to put any there are many questions posed here. I have a few, but it's amazing we're running
out of time.
Yeah, although we have another 9 minutes. But Michelle, do you want to bring anything out or ask anything of Tanu about this international dimension of recent events?
I think that was a pretty thorough briefing. I don't have any questions at the moment.
One thing, let me go ahead. Okay, I think we're still connected. It's probably just the age of cell phones. Just can we take then a minute or two about some of the on the specifics about this? I don't mean about the river or anything else, but the stakes are very high when it comes to the state of natural resources, which in varying degrees around the world we've been using iron ore, coal, and everything else. India has coal, but they've been using it like crazy for many decades,
right.
For example.
Mm-hmm.
Would you get, and on other programs you've reviewed the commitment that's being expressed by India, China, and Russia for nuclear power.
Absolutely.
But tell us about the depletion of coal, or would there be hydropower connected to the Brahmaputra, or because of the silt management and everything, maybe not?
Well, I think it's about if we can exploit the entire hydropower of Brahmaputra River and all the other, there are 54 rivers involved in the Brahmaputra basin. And then, of course, if we consider Nepal, there are very large rivers which really don't come into Brahmaputra Basin, but they come into Ganga, Ganges River. Now, if you take all these into account, the power, hydropower generation capabilities anywhere near 185,000 megawatt or something like that. But that is, again, it's still a finite amount. What they are looking at now, and finally this realization, and I cannot help but pat our own back by saying that, well, all the way back in 1980s, we said that neither India nor China has any possibility of developing without developing nuclear power in a vast amount of nuclear power. Now that realization has dawned upon them, and they are also doing it in a good way, that they are thinking of doing the breeder reactor so that we don't run out of nuclear fuel. And here again, United States could make an enormous amount of contribution and also participate in this thing to not only to help the region but to help himself. But there is no question that hydropower is preferred over coal. But coal has its use, there is no question about it. At the coal head, if you build power plants, there is no problem whatsoever. It is the dragging the coal thousands and thousands of millions of tons, by railroad and all that, which really destroys the infrastructure of the country. But if we can develop, coal mine head, coal-fired power plants, it's fine, and we can take the power out of there. So, but they're moving into nuclear.
Right, so I think it's just part of the agenda of what humanity would be interested in doing.
Yes,
if we
absolutely.
Weren't trying, once we, it, if we roll back the British no-growth depopulation, in fact, Tanu hasn't, we're running out of time, but I want to tell everyone, he has an article that's coming up in the EIR online next week, mm-hmm. that goes into the opposition to everything he just described, which not surprisingly is based in the British Foreign Office type people who are in the United Nations and affiliated with a group also called International Rivers. And they say, no, it hurts local people, the indigenous people, to have things like dams and projects.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I have always noticed, and it is not difficult to notice anyway, is that the drug runs through areas where there is no development. Now, if you look at the Northeast India, the drug runners are going through there, drug gun runners. And these are all being financed, supported, instigated by the British Empire servers. And, of course, the financiers often are Saudis and other. And there are obvious enemies of India exist, and Pakistan considers itself as an enemy of India, so Pakistan dips into it, but they cannot organize this thing. These things are organized on a basis of, if development is cut off, then this drug running, and that's the way it runs in Afghanistan, that's the way it ran in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, and that's the way it runs to Myanmar today. And so there is always the vested interest, because British Empire is always looking for the drug money in order to keep the City of London banks afloat. And so therefore, once the drug money is cut off, there is no economy left of Britain anymore.
Well, I think you've touched on the enemy yet again, not just touched on, but that's who it is. And that's what we're up against, on who's pulling the strings of President Obama, who must be got out of the way. He can resign. He can be impeached. And so, in the remaining seconds, Michelle, I turn to you with, and I just say that with just the appeal to everyone listening. You know where the Executive Intelligence Review is. Subscribe to all your enemies and get one for all your enemies and friends. You can call 800-278-3135. Those of you who are not participating online, 800-278-3135. And activate in the way that Michelle has just said. Yeah. Michelle, you have tremendous authority for many reasons. You're a strong woman and a strong leader, but you're speaking from Washington, D.C. And why don't you close out the show and tell people what they ought to be doing over the Easter holiday, Passover?
Well, the most important thing is to go back and make sure that you have a clear idea on what the intent of the American Revolution actually was, and what we're really fighting for, what has been the historic fight of the United States. It has very connected to this fight against the British Empire and the fight for development, and really the fight for global development. But not just understanding the intentions, understanding the methods, the methods that work, that we've employed in our history in order to at least get us as far as we have come, but what we could lose if we're not clear on what it is that we do that we did need.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that's exactly what we better be doing.
Thank you, Michelle.
And thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Tanu. And thanks, everyone, for March 27th, 2010, the LaRouche Show. And listen next week, April 3rd. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.